thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
This is Digital Campus number 28 for the 17th of June, 2008. Raising the Bar Camp. I'm Dan Cohen. Welcome back to Digital Campus. We're glad you could join us. And this week we have the regulars on the line. Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hi, Dan.
And Tom Scheinfeld, who's joining us from a landline this time. Hi there, Tom.
Hi, guys. Sorry, I apologize to all the listeners for my sound quality. The District of Columbia seems to be in complete chaos with fires in the metro and power outages. So I didn't make it out to campus today, and I don't have my headset. So if my sound's a little bad, that's why.
Yeah, you know, we should explain to our international audience that even though we live in the capital of a superpower, somehow we have a lot of power outages in the Washington, D.C. area. My power was out for a couple of days the other week. We're also in the, a lot of people don't realize that Washington is in at the end of the tornado corridor that is in the United States that starts out in the Midwest and it's sort of a stripe across the United States. We're actually at the end of that. So we do get strong winds and occasional tornadoes. And so we've had a lot of power outages. And I think almost a tornado came by CH&M or a near tornado came by this CH&M pretty recently, a week ago. So anyway, Tom, we're glad you could join us by phone. And let's kick right in. Well, I guess it's unavoidable to discuss the 3G iPhone. You know, I guess I'm the only one still with an iPhone here. Mills, Tom, is this make you want to bite that there's now a cheaper, faster iPhone with GPS in it?
Yeah, I think I'm going to bite. My problem with the iPhone has been all along, and I've said this on the show before, is the lack of a physical keyboard. But I've kind of realized in having my BlackBerry now for a whole year that I don't want the physical keyboard anymore. It ties me too much to my email. And so I'm happy to get rid of the physical keyboard, and the speed of the connection and the new features I think are just going to kind of put me over the edge. So I'll probably be going out on July 11th as soon as it's out and waiting in line to get one.
Yeah, I think. Well, I'm going to wait and see what happens with Father's Day that's coming up. But hint to one listener to the podcast. But I don't know. You know, I'm really bad about stepping on telephones and losing them and things like that. So dropping them in the pool. And so I think still $200 might be above my price point. But we're going to have to see how the summer goes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess you should explain that beyond the technology of it. You know, in terms of its relationship to some of the things we've been discussing on the podcast, you know, we did name mobile as being, I think, the key trend for 2008. And I think we've been right about this, actually. And I do think that the big story is going to be iPhone usage on campus. And indeed, there was a rumor that in addition to this 3G iPhone, they are thinking about letting campus technology stores sell the iPhone, which I think would really change the landscape of this. And I wonder if that would include a more significant discount for students. But the iPhone interface along with Android, which I think is going, you know, the open source iPhone-esque operating system for mobile from Google, which I think is going to have a lot of traction. It looks really good and allows for a lot of the feature set that the iPhone has. I think between those two things, we're going to have a lot of smartphone users on campus in 2009. And I've enjoyed having the iPhone and more than that, enjoyed jailbreaking my iPhone, which is the act of sort of doing a little hack on your iPhone to install non-sanctioned applications. Is I really feel it gives me a window into 2009, 2010, the kinds of things that will be possible on mobile on campus, like location-based access to information, various kinds of messaging systems. You know, it really sort of opens up your imagination when you jailbreak your iPhone and install these applications. Of course, after June 11th, you won't have to do any of that because there'll be an application store and you'll be able to legally download this. But I think it's going to open up a lot of eyes on campuses, in museums and libraries, the kinds of new applications that will be available on mobile.
I mean, in addition to the high-speed connection for the iPhone, I think that, you know, the big story here really is the built-in true GPS to this phone. And I think, you know, there have been GPS devices around, you know, consumer GPS devices around for a long time, and we've talked about them, and we've bought a few and played with them and stuff. The difference between the iPhone and those earlier devices is I think that the iPhone provides a really nice applications programming platform for a GPS-enabled device. Like the earlier devices, the Garmins and the Dells and all those kinds of handheld GPS devices, you basically use the software that came on them. This device, I think, allows people and educators and museum professionals and others, it will allow them to actually build custom apps for the built-in technology of the built-in GPS. And I think that will push us forward. I think prior to this, you know, you could use it for what you could use it for, but you couldn't really be imaginative. I think that the iPhone and the App Store and you know the development kit will allow us to let our imaginations run wild. So I think that's really the biggest story, I think, here.
Well, and for me, I think that's exactly right, because I mean my imagination's already run wild. I have I'm teaching a course, a field studies course next summer, where we're going to spend, a group of students and I are going to spend 2 weeks actually in the field doing place-based computing. And so when I started reading this story, I mean, I was planning on doing this all with GPS devices and then kind of going through the cranky process of coordinating the historical data that we're going to gather out in the field with other kinds of applications. And so to be able to do it seamlessly in an iPhone, I think it's just going to be great. So I'm already thinking about how I'm going to write that grant application to Apple to say, here's, you know, I'm developing a whole new application for place-based education, and so I need, you know, 20 of these for my students.
Yeah, I agree. I think, and you know, some of this may be able to take place on the iPod Touch, even though it's not going to have the GPS. But, you know, I think you could still have some applications for that, which is, you know, it's obviously going to be a cheaper device because you won't have to have the service contract on it. But I do think this opens up a realm of possibilities. I mean, I know the three of us, we've talked about, you know, possible history applications or things that maybe, let's say, the National Park Service could do if they knew that a certain segment of the population visiting, you know, sites around the United States had an integrated GPS on their phone, you know, with a very rich interface. The possibilities of that, I think, are pretty astonishing. So, and I would encourage people, you know, at least if they're listening to this in June when it's coming out, 2008, you know, over the next month, you can go and look at some of the existing applications for jailbroken phones. There are good lists, for instance, at lifehacker.com. Just do a search on that site for iPhone and jailbreak, and it'll list, you know, the top 10 applications, and you'll see the really wide variety of things that you could do on a phone that has that kind of feature set. And it's really becoming a sort of full-fledged computer that's mobile. And so, and I think in that way, it's really different than, you know, bring your laptop somewhere and loading up some kind of application. It really enables, I think, new things. And I think we'll just have to think through what is actually possible here. And what you could do once you know where, let's say, a phone user is and the kind of information that could be delivered instantly to that device. Is there anything negative from this iPhone announcement that you'd like to see on that kind of a platform?
Well, I think one negative, I know Jeremy Boggs in one of our developers in the center, he just bought one of the old iPhones, and you know, the price has come down now to $200, and he just spent $400 on his iPhone. So I think there are going to be a lot of angry first generation iPhone owners out there. But I do think that the platform has really improved, and I think this is mostly good news. The one thing I think I'd say is I'm not sure that I'm entirely happy with the notion that I'm going to have to buy all the applications, or even if they're free, get them through the iTunes Music Store. It seems like a fairly closed universe. And I mean, Apple is all about the kind of closed universe, always has been. But this seems even more closed than what they've done, for instance, with the Mac. And so I'm a little concerned that, you know, Apple is going to be vetting these applications. Apple's going to be deciding which ones get into the store, which ones don't, which ones are highlighted on the homepage, which ones aren't. And so for smaller application developers, for people who are doing experimental projects, I worry that Apple will have be exercising a little bit too much control to let, you know, kind of a thousand flowers bloom. But other than that, I can't see too many negatives.
Yeah, I will say sort of the counter argument on that is that for this to have any kind of ease of use in the educational environment, it's got to be simply downloaded from the iTunes store or some central place like that, because the average faculty and student user just needs that simplicity.
Did you notice that in the announcement, they actually mentioned something about being able to distribute up to 100 people in an ad hoc way applications? I kind of wonder about that piece of it. There may be some way for kind of small scale, you know, class size distribution where, you know, you don't need to go through some kind of, you know, sign up to be an official developer, et cetera. It was a little bit unclear to me. It may be for the enterprise only. And I wonder if universities would qualify in a sense to get some kind of enterprise plan where it seems like would be great for use in the classroom, because you could actually, I think, distribute these things and wipe them out or alter them from a central location, which is always what, you know, big institutions like universities want to do. And I think as part of that, you can put some of these applications on it directly. So you could say, well, for all History 101 students, we want this program that Mills came up with, and we only want it for those people for the next 3 months, and then, you know, sort of wipe it after that and get the phones back. It's a little bit unclear to me what that one line was about being able to distribute up to 100 phones on an ad hoc basis. But I guess we'll have to see. We'll have to see about these licensing requirements too, which undoubtedly are going to clash with some of the intellectual property arrangements that universities normally like to have. Because the developers program, it really seems like for individual developers, I'm not sure how a university as a whole would sign up for that.
Where it's going to run into trouble is along those lines, because I've been, you know, we've been struggling with the whole iTunes U thing here at George Mason for the last year and a half. And one of the big issues has to do with copyright and licensing agreements, because not so much for historians, but in a variety of other disciplines, faculty members have some arrangement with a publisher to use a variety of graphics in a lecture that came from a textbook or something like that. And so they've said, well, I can't make my podcasts available to, you know, with any of these kinds of images. I can't make that available to the general public. And so because that would violate the terms of these agreements that I've signed. And so my podcasts have to be behind the password and blocked from general access. You know, only students in my class can actually listen to it. And this has just been a real hairball for us to try to deal with. And in fact, I think has really retarded the rollout of that iTunes U platform at George Mason. Yeah. The other problem is an authentication issue, which I have to say Apple has never been able to work out with the people at Mason. And then, you know, the people at Mason say it's Apple's fault. I'm sure the Apple people say it's Mason's fault. But basically, the authentication issues we've just kind of thrown up our hands and given up.
Right. Yeah. I mean, those are very complicated when you've got already a complicated legal landscape for this application store, and then you mesh that with and a complicated technical infrastructure for that application store, and then you mesh that with the complications of a university legal and technical environment, authentication is a really, really good point. It seems like most of these applications are meant to be, you know, downloaded to any phone and used by anyone, and that's going to be really hard to figure out how to limit those sorts of things. Well, I'm sure we'll talk much more about this, and I suppose we should cover Android when that's officially out. You know, 250,000 people have downloaded the software development kit for the iPhone. It's pretty astonishing, and including some people here at the Center for History and New Media. It'll be interesting to see if we can come up with some initial applications to throw up there. Well, in other news, using technology for another reason, Tom forwarded a pretty interesting article about peer-to-peer loans and how this might work to help out college students. Tom, you want to fill us in on this story?
Yeah, there's a new company that's launching, I guess just launched, called GreenNote. And what essentially they do is offer small sort of microfinance loans to students, basically on the model of microfinancing that has gone on in the developing world, where and you know, companies like Grameen Bank and others have done this, where you give, you know, you can give a small $100 or $500 or $1,000 loan directly to in the case of the developing world, a small business, or in the case of GreenNote, a student. You can give them that loan, and the company, the GreenNote or the bank, is sort of the middleman. They do all of the servicing of the loan, the invoicing and the tracking the loan and all of that, and you get the interest from the loan. And so this allows basically for people with resources to provide students without them with college loans. And they're basically modeled on the Stafford loan. So the interest rate is the same as a federal Stafford loan. And the terms are the same as the federal Stafford loan. It's just that you're doing this in small amounts directly with a student who you have an interest with. And then what this company allows you to do is pick the student that you want to service, and you can read their profile, and it's in some ways a nice little investment for an investor, because they can sort of see the progress of the student. Student loans have very low default rates, so it's a fairly safe investment. And it's, you know, it's at 6 or 7%. It's a better interest rate than you're going to get in a savings account or even in a CD. So it's kind of an interesting model of using technology to put people in contact, people sort of outside of the academy, outside of the world of education, in contact with students who are looking to get into that world. And so, you know, it has worked very well in the developing world with financing, you know, very, very small businesses, tea shops and other kinds of very small businesses. And it could work, I think, for student loans, especially in this economic climate where there's such a credit crunch and where getting student loans, commercial loans, outside of the $18,000 or whatever that the federal government offers you is so difficult. So this is something of a new model, I think a timely new model that we should keep an eye on.
Well, and in fact, you know, it's a new delivery system for an old model, because my father went to college on a plan, through a plan just like this. He grew up very poor in Tampa, Florida, and there was a local radio DJ who had no children of his own. And so he would pay for the first semester tuition, room and board and books for a deserving student from the Tampa area, with the understanding that someday they would pay him back. And back in those days, if you went to college and you made straight A's, then the college would find a way to keep you. And so that's how my father stayed in college, was by making straight A's pretty much the whole time. But it was probably 15 years before he made enough money to pay this man back the $300 or $400 that first semester cost back in the day. So it's the same system. It's just a much better delivery, much more efficient delivery system.
Much like the iPhone, I think it does sort of spur the imagination to think of other things that could use this peering system to assist students. Previously, I suppose the only application of this has been for the exchange of essays and plagiarism. But this is intriguing. I wonder if this will actually take off. I guess we will have to see. The three of us really had a terrific time at a new conference that started this year at the Center for History and New Media. You may have heard about it. It was called That Camp, with the That acronym being the Humanities and Technology Camp, and the website for it at thatcamp.org. And it was the first really unconference or bar camp, and we'll have to explain what those terms mean, that I've been to. And I think that the rest of us, Mills and Tom, this is the first time you've been to one of these as well, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So what we want to do is sort of explain what that camp was and the way in which it might fit in pretty well into the world of museums and libraries and universities and colleges, which all have these regular conferences. And I think all three of us felt it might provide a kind of new model for at least part of these conferences that we all go to, these academic conferences. So maybe, Tom, if you could kick us off by telling us a little bit about that camp, what it was, and sort of the unusual way in which we started the weekend at the conference.
Sure. Well, we had the idea for that camp several years ago, and we thought about, wouldn't it be nice to just get a whole bunch of people with similar interests together for a kind of working weekend? And this was right about the same time that the bar camp or unconference trend was taking hold in the world of IT, more generally, and web development and Web 2.0. And a bar camp or an unconference, and these, you get into these definitional battles that people in the world of IT like to get into. But essentially, they're all sort of the same in that they differ from an ordinary conference in a couple of ways. First, that the sessions aren't planned in advance. The sessions are planned mostly on the day of the conference. And the way that happened in the case of that camp was we encouraged people who wanted to come to the conference to email us with a vague idea of what they might want to talk about or what they might want to learn, the kind of reasons that they wanted to come to the conference, and just a little bit about themselves. And we made our decisions on the applications just on kind of who sounded most enthusiastic, who had the best questions, who had the most interesting ideas. And so we made some decisions about who could come. And then we encouraged those people who were accepted into the conference to go to a blog. We set up a blog and to post some of their ideas and to try to start conversations about things we might talk about, try to start those conversations ahead of time, but no kind of formal proposals for panels or papers. Just throw out some ideas, try to start some conversations. And then when we got to the conference, on the first morning of the conference, the first slot was a plenary session where we all got together and we looked at that blog and we tried to pick out some general trends. What are the kinds of things people are interested in? And from there, we put it to the audience. Are you guys still interested in these topics? Someone proposed doing something on GPS. Who's interested in GPS? We saw a show of hands. We said, okay, well, that seems like something we should talk about. Who wants to go to a session on GPS? Another show of hands. And we scheduled the time slots in the rooms based on kind of the interests of the crowd, what people were interested in doing on that morning. So it was really a kind of ad hoc program. And sort of the other way it differs from an ordinary conference is that there are no just attendees. Everybody has to be an active participant in the conference. Nobody can just sit there and listen or take notes. And in fact, no one is really standing up at a podium and presenting a paper either. There were no formal papers. There were no red papers. Everyone was there to demo a project or test the technology or discuss a problem or an issue. to with the audience. And so everybody was required to present or demo or propose something. And so all of the sessions ended up being very collaborative. So those are sort of the two differences, is that the program was a kind of ad hoc program just based on the collective interests of the people there. And the sessions themselves were much more informal, much more discussion-based, much more kind of collaborative than an ordinary paper session you would have at an ordinary conference.
Yeah, and just to let our audience know, I mean, some of the things that came up, just to read from the schedule, we had sessions on text mining and digital art, the act of teaching, you know, how you teach a digital humanities course. We had something on virtual worlds, crowdsourcing, questions about civil engagement and research methods, games, street maps, open street maps. We had something on graphics programming and infrastructure and sustainability, and various hacking sessions on different programs, including two of our major open source programs here at the center, Omeka and Zotero. And visualization and GIS and mashups had a lot of interest as well. So it's really across the board, these sessions, right, Tom?
Yeah, it was. And you know, depending on the interest of people in the crowd, we had about five different spaces that we used. We had two kind of conference rooms that fit about 25 people each. We had a smaller, our lab space, which maybe fit about 15 people around a widescreen TV. And then we had two sort of smaller breakout areas, just large tables where people could congregate, and those were, you know, 8 to 12 people. And so depending on the interest of the session, people just kind of congregated in the space that was right for them. And, you know, if it was a hacking session, people tended to want to sit around a table. If it was more of a project demonstration session, then we did it in a larger conference room. So you know, sort of depending on the interest, we assigned the rooms that way. So it really was that the spaces also fit the topics, I think, very well. So that was kind of cool, too.
Mills, what was your experience as a first-timer to this kind of, you know, relatively unstructured event?
I was trying to think of a way that I could convert all of my professional conferences to this model because, you know, I mean, we've all been to academic conferences, and they all have kind of moderate interest value. Mostly the sessions are an opportunity to sort of find out what somebody's doing that might be interesting, and sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. It's a chance to go and be supportive of a friend or a colleague who's giving a paper. It's a chance for graduate students to present themselves to a wider audience. It's, you know, a variety of things like that, but mostly they're, especially at least in history, I don't go to museum conferences or political science conferences, but in history, they tend to be pretty doggone boring. Especially the, you know, the late afternoon sessions, it's often really hard to stay awake. And it's not because the information being communicated isn't worthy or interesting. It's just having papers read to you for hours on end is, after a while, you know, the brain recoils. And so this was just so much more stimulating and engaging, and it wasn't, you know, also the other flaw I think in academic conferences is that there's a fair amount of posturing that goes on, and there really was none at this unconference that we held. It was really an opportunity for people of like mind and like interest to get together and share ideas and possible projects and talk about what they were up to and really collaborate in the true sense of the word of collaboration. That's I think the thing that really impressed me the most was the really high degree of collaboration that went on. So you know, I was thinking about this and thinking, well, what about the American Historical Association conference or the My Home conference, which is a Slavic studies conference? And I think that there's really going to be a place within those conferences for a kind of sub-conference like this, where things like this can happen. I think it's not the case that, you know, the American Historical Association annual meeting could switch entirely to an unconference model, but in part because graduate students do need the opportunity to present themselves to potential department employers by showing off their work a little bit, and this model doesn't really provide that as easily. And also, the funding model that we live in is that you get money if you're going to a conference to give a paper. And so as opposed to, right, I'm right. Trying to imagine how I would make the case to the dean's office of, well, I'm going to a conference to sit around and talk.
Well, and it's indeed written into the kind of tenure and promotion rules, right? I mean, you know, presenting a paper at the annual conference is a sort of, you know, a kind of quasi-publication. It's part of your, you know, what is expected of you as an active participant in the profession. So, yes, going to sit somewhere and drink coffee and do something
really interesting and productive, you know, that doesn't count. And you know, in a lot of places, I mean, you know, our institution is not as formal about this, but a lot of institutions are extremely formal about, you know, they have counting systems that presenting a paper at a conference counts X points and chairing a session only counts X minus four or something like that. And like in the UK, for instance, there's, you know, everything is spelled out in their annual evaluation scheme. So, there's no place for collaborative work in these counting schemes.
We should mention that the attendees were from all kinds of parts of the university library museum world. I mean, we had programmers, we had librarians, we had professors, you know, tenured and non-tenured. We had project management people, we had foundation project officers, sort of everyone who's involved in this world of humanities and technology was there. And it really felt, you know, non-hierarchical that, you know, people were really willing to work with, you know, people of different stripes and at different stations in life and in the profession, because they felt that those people might have information that was of interest to them and that they could learn from those people. And, you know, I found the academic conferences, beside the sort of careerism that goes on there, it is a very hierarchical place. I mean, the AHA, you see kind of glaze-eyed graduate students who've, you know, are just about to finish their dissertation, who are on the job market, and they're sort of walking around between interviews or hoping to schmooze with the right people. And there was really none of that at that camp.
Yeah, I wrote a blog post following the camp about this, and I pointed out sort of three differences between that camp, just in terms of atmospherics and process, between that camp and other kinds of conferences, and the democratic nature of that camp was one of the things that I pointed to, that there really wasn't a whole lot of concern about status, that graduate students and full professors were able to kind of mix it up in a very open way and share information very, very openly. The other two things that I mentioned were that I thought that that camp was very honest. I thought that people were not there. You know, Dan, you used the word posturing, and I think you do get a lot of posturing at traditional conferences where everyone, at least it's been my experience, everyone is sort of there to prove how smart they are and to kind of outsmart the competition. And there was really none of that at that camp either. I mean, people were very honest. What I thought was very interesting, and I thought the most productive thing, people were really honest about not about their successes, but about their failures, where they had problems, where things that they were trying to do but couldn't do, where they didn't have the resources, where they didn't have the knowledge, and that allowed for, I think, some really productive exchanges where people were really helping each other to solve their problems rather than trying to sweep those problems under the rug and pretend like, you know, they had kind of mastered their field and they were in complete command of the issues. I thought that was really, really very nice. I think the other thing to point out about that camp, that I did in my blog post, is that it was really inexpensive. We were able to do this on a relative shoestring, and really there was no funding for the conference. We didn't have a grant for it. We got some sponsorships from the GMU Provost's office, a small sponsorship from them, a small sponsorship from NEECH, the network in Canadian history and environment, and a small sponsorship from the New York Public Library. Other than that, we asked for $20 donations from the participants. We literally passed around a hat. And between those 20 buck donations and some small sort of sponsorships for a lunch here and a breakfast there, we were able to put on a very nice conference with t-shirts and breakfast, really nice breakfast and lunch buffets each day, office supplies, and even a couple of travel stipends for students. So, you know, it's another model. You don't need $100,000 to bring people together to actually have a good weekend, a good productive working weekend.
Well, and it seems like that the fact that it was done on a shoestring changed the expectations game for it. I mean, when you get a very formal conference, something like the AHA or in the library world, the ALA, those kinds of conferences that are at the Marriott, that have the ballroom, you know, there is a certain formality that is just sort of enforced by that kind of environment. And so I think people did feel more open because we weren't sitting in rows of, you know, gilded chairs in a ballroom. I think that really helped out. And people pitched in to, you know, help clean up, to those sorts of things that yeah. you wouldn't normally see at a conference. Okay, but before we say that this was the greatest thing since sliced bread, I mean, doesn't the bar camp or unconference idea come out of a different world than that of academia, more technology world where, say, people might be used to collaborating more often like programmers do on a big project? How well does this map onto something like the AHA? And what might actually be the kind of takeaways for conference planners in the world of academia?
Well, I think that's a fair point. I think it does map. It maps onto digital humanities and digital history better than it does onto traditional scholarship. I think that's a fair point. I think it could be very easily transferred to fields like public history, where the work is very collaborative, to the museum field and to libraries as well, where work is done in teams. And you know, the single authored monograph is not the end all be all of professional success. So I think that in some worlds it's going to fit better than others. But I do think that there is room, even in the traditional fields, for a frank discussion of issues, for an honest and open discussion of challenges and problems, for real community between graduate students and tenured faculty. So those kinds of things I think could be beneficial to traditional fields as well. So it probably does map on better to fields where the nature of the work is, you know, by necessity collaborative. I think there are things that could be transferred to more traditional fields as well.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to see at the AHA if you could have a session that, let's say, graduate students who were not at the end of their dissertation process and thus on the job market and having that scared look on their face, but ones maybe near the beginning of their dissertation process who could go into, you know, micro groups of common interest and, you know, get advice from more senior scholars in the field. I mean, beyond just their, let's say, their dissertation director. I mean, that is a fairly appealing thing. So, I don't know if that's a possibility, but you know, I'd like to you know, see that in the future. Okay, so in the spirit of unconference sharing, why don't we have our picks for the week? Mills, what do you have for us this week?
Well, mine is one I picked up at that camp, and that is the OpenStreetMap.org. And if you're not familiar with OpenStreetMap, they are creating, in a collaborative open source environment, a free editable map of the entire world where individuals are uploading all the data. Why I'm particularly excited about this is not the free access to mapping data, but instead to use the same platform to start building historical maps. And so we're going to download some of the patches. It's a Ruby on Rails application, and we're going to download some of the patches that make it possible to use it in historical time instead of in present time, and this summer play around with it a little bit and see if we can't create some historical maps this way. So it should be fun.
Yeah, it's really a neat site. So you should check that out. It's at openstreetmap.org. Of course, we'll link to all of the picks and other links from this week at digitalcampus.tv. Tom, why don't we go to you?
Okay, thanks. I've got sort of a shameless plug, if people will indulge me. My pick of the week is the Gulag Many Days, Many Lives site that CHNM just launched last week. It's at gulaghistory.org. And it is CH&M's first online exhibition, sort of a museum exhibition, a museum online exhibition without the physical exhibition. And it is a comprehensive history of the Soviet Gulag. And the title, Many Days, Many Lives, comes from it's kind of a play on Solzhenitsyn's title, A Day in the Life. And the main thesis of the site is that the Gulag didn't exist as a single experience or a single institution. It wasn't just one day or one life. It was many different experiences experienced by hundreds of thousands of people over the course of half a century. And so we take people through the experience of the Gulag through the eyes of the people who experienced it. And so in kind of the way as if people have been to the Holocaust Museum in D.C., you're given a prisoner at the entrance to the museum, and you follow that person's story as you follow the path through the museum. In this exhibition, you're also assigned a prisoner, and you learn about that person's Gulag experience through the various stages of a Gulag experience. So through their capture, their work, their suffering, their relationships with the guards, their survival, their fate, and you learn their fate at the end of the exhibit. And so it's kind of new territory for CH&M, moving into sites not for scholars or not for teachers, but for general audiences. So we're really excited about that. It's built on the Omeka platform, so if people are interested in using Omeka, it's really a great example of the kind of rich narrative exhibition you can do with Omeka. So we're very proud of it, and I hope people will visit it at gulaghistory.org.
Yeah, terrific site, beautifully designed, and has really outstanding content. I mean, I didn't know that much about the Gulag. It really is, I think, a mystery probably to a lot of non-Russians, and I think this is a terrific place to start. Great for the classroom, great for those just interested in history. Terrific. Well, my pick for the week is actually a way that I've discovered that has been around in the Mac operating system for the last year, but I've recently been using it to try to have an environment in which to write. And I know we've thrown out a lot of suggestions for this to kind of reduce the clutter on your screen and get those distractions out of the way so you can focus on a single task. And I know we've all come up with different solutions, but I've been now using Spaces in OS X. And I don't know, do the two of you use Spaces at all?
No. Yeah, totally.
It's Tom, you do?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I use
it's really
pretty heavily.
Yeah, it's really terrific. So, it's one of these things that it's not on by default, but, if you go into System Preferences and click on Expose and Spaces, you can actually line up multiple screens, that sort of virtual screens that exist, and then you can just press a key and switch back and forth between, let's say, two screens and have one screen be your email and your web browser and your Twitter and all those things that pop up and get in your face and, want to distract you. And indeed, I was thinking about this as I was reading a really terrific book. Actually, this will be my second pick of the week, which is an actual book called Dave Gorman's Google Whack Adventure. Dave Gorman is a British comedian. He's very hilarious. And he wrote a book just about using Google to essentially distract himself from writing the book that he was supposed to write. So it's very apropos. And he's got this great line about how, whoever thought that the work environment for the 21st century would be a window into the most distracting world that you can imagine, that you'd have your word processor up next to your web browser, which has access to all this incredible stuff and constantly distracts you. So check out Spaces if you haven't used it. It's really easy to switch back and forth, and you can just have one window be your word processing document, or if you're working on a blog post, just your browser, and just have that one app environment with no distractions at all. It's really easy to use. And again, that's only for those Mac users. And it's in your System Preferences under Expose and Spaces. Just an editor's note, we want to remind people that beside going to digitalcampus.tv to write comments on posts, you can also now call us. So if you're listening to this in the car, you can call us on your cell phone at 703-879-5. 4796. We had a little bit of a technical issue last week, but that should be resolved and the number should be available. And if you call in, we'll add your comment from that line onto our blog at digitalcampus.tv. So, Tom, glad you could join us on the regular phone. We'll talk to you on Skype next time. And Mills, thanks for talking to you on regular Skype. And we'll see all of our audience next time on another episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.